Welcome to the fourth wall.
Hello, everyone. My name is Arthur Robinson,
co-editor of the Fourth Wall Podcast, and
before we start with our new batch of interviews, Fourth Wall exclusive interviews, I'd like to take a moment and explain a few things.
It's the first week of 2010, and our plan is to do more interviews with more people in the comics industry, and not just like traditional comics. I mean, we're trying to really breach out the gap and talk to people in the comics medium, people who work with webcomics, people who work with hypercomics, indie comics, do-it-yourself people. We're trying to really branch out. We have more things to come over the other 11 months or so, but I think this one is a great start that we're kicking off with.
And to really start the new year off right, we're starting with a rising star in the comics industry. Daniel Merlin Gridbury
has been hitting the net hard with his new concepts on webcomics with All Knowledge is Strange, Brain Fist, and Empire of Odd. He's also worked on some graphic novels with AIT Planet Lar, like The Last Sane Cowboy and other stories. And his latest with the company is Necessary Monsters with artist Sean, and I know I'm going to get this wrong, as a party. You could read any of his work right now by clicking on the corresponding links that you see below the podcast, but I really strongly suggest picking up the trade when it comes out in February. Please enjoy the interview, and please excuse the awkwardness that is Arthur Robinson talking to somebody famous. Enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Fourth Wall exclusive interview. It's me, Arthur Robinson, solo this time, and, well, yeah, so.
Good start.
Yeah, fantastic. Oh, boy. But we have a guest, as you can hear by the disembodied voice on the podcast.
Hello.
Daniel Merlin, and, excuse me if I'm saying this right, Gridbury?
Hey, yeah, good stab at it, yeah. Better than most people manage.
Oh, yes, we got him to talk about a whole bunch of stuff. He's a pioneer, pretty much, in webcomics, and we're here to talk about a lot of his things. I wanted to talk about his Necessary Monsters book, but he's got so many things, so many different webcomics that you can read right now while you're actually listening to this thing. But just let's start with the basics.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, right, the basics. Well, I'm a comics creator in England, as you can probably tell from my accent. I've been making comics on the web since around 98, 99, and I started off doing very kind of experimental formalist comics, and now I still do those, but I also do kind of what's now kind of standard web comic style of serializing things on the web and then eventually collecting them in print. And I've got my next print book of a webcomic, Necessary Monsters, coming out in February, which is why I'm running around desperately trying to get people to buy it. And Necessary Monsters has been serialized on the web for about the last year and a half, 2 years, I think. So this is our first kind of big story arc collection.
Yeah, I was thinking about how to do this interview and conduct it, because I assume that not too many people really know about you, yourself, and your work, and I was trying to go in that mindset, but then, like, I kind of woke up early and was like, no, I gotta ask him something. What if he asked me, how'd you think about Necessary Monsters or something? So I pretty much read every webcomic I possibly could get my hands onto, like Brain Fist, and, which is also coming out. When is Brain Fist?
It's out, but it's only coming out from me, so it's only available from conventions and now from my website. I finally got the shop working on my website this afternoon, so you can now buy the Brain Fist trade, which is in full color, exciting, from my website, email.com as well. And it's the first time I've actually self-published something, because before that I've always, for trades, gone through a publisher.
Gone with, like, this was, AIT. And so
AIT for my two trades so far. I just thought with Brain Fist I would probably make about as much money on it if I just sold it myself than I would soliciting it for Diamond and etc. So I thought I'd just self-publish it.
Gotcha.
So I had something else for conventions.
So just handing it out and like.
I want a third trade because I've got like I started to notice that I only really make money at conventions from selling trades rather than from selling single issues. Brainfist had been sitting around complete as a webcomic for a few years now. I think I finished it in 2007. So I decided to finally kind of get it together and just get the book out myself so it was there.
Do you have any other plans to just do like your entire work? Do you like All Knowledge is Strange and then Empire of the Eye? Are you planning on?
Yeah, I mean, All Knowledge is Strange I want to do as a trade at some point. I'll wait till it's finished and then look at how long it is and figure out the best way to do it. It might even be two trades because it's longer than Brainfist. Things like Empire of Odd, I don't know. I try and do all my stuff that's not crazy formalist stuff, so they could be collected in print at some point now, whereas my early stuff, I wasn't thinking about that, so it was a little harder to adapt it, but eventually I think I want to do like a collection of all the odds and ends I've got, because I've got a lot of kind of random short things from all over the place, so I try and put some kind of B-sides collection out at some point, I think. Have things like Empire of Odd, and the odd little, I've done a bunch of little things for other anthologies and stuff. I'd like to get them all together in one place.
Because you also do these hyper comics, and it's like, there's no way.
Yeah. No, they're just for the web, mostly. I thought about putting out like a DVD of them at some point, but I just don't think there's really a market for it. So I leave them as web pieces. And then, that's where they belong.
So what got you into the whole comics and the, like hitting the net hard with these web comics?
Well, I was a multimedia student when I was doing my degree back in like around 98, and I started doing some. I was always comics reading. I started doing some kind of like some simple kind of photo comic type stuff and playing around with a program called Poser that does 3D artwork very simply. And via the old Warren Ellis forum, I met. Alastair Watson, who wrote a book, collaborated with me on a comic called Rust, which he was writing and I was illustrating. That was one of the first times I really started to think about the potential of comics on the screen as opposed to comics on the page. And off the back of that, I kind of got more and more interested in doing experimental web comics and just kind of figuring out what comics could be. I was around then going on to do my master's degree in hyperfiction, which is kind of interactive narrative stuff. And also around that time, I read Scott McCloud's Reinventing Comics, and he was talking about all these things that comics could do on the screen that they couldn't do on the page. And it sounded really interesting to me, but when I looked online, there just weren't that many people really pursuing some of the things he was talking about. So I decided to just have a go at doing some of the different things he was saying could possibly be done, and then try and kind of apply what I was learning about interactive narrative and kind of narratives on the web to comics. And that's what really got me going on really thinking I wanted to create comics all the time rather than just as a kind of like sideline thing. And that was the start of me as a comics creator as opposed to just a guy kind of mucking around with comics.
Are you planning on going back to the hyper comics world, or you're staying with the web comics in general?
Yeah, I mean, for a while I kind of wasn't because I felt like I'd done that. But the last year or so, I have been going back there a bit more. More on kind of commissioned work. I've been doing. I did some work with Sony on their PSP comics, and I did an installation piece in Paris, which is actually opening properly. Like the grand opening is this weekend, so I'm going back to Paris for that. Which was a hypercomic in a children's mental health clinic in Paris, which was again a big kind of wall installation type thing. And I also did an exhibition of hypercomic stuff in Seoul in Korea this year. So I've actually been doing a lot more hypercomics again in the last year than I had for a while. So I'm kind of slightly dipping my toes back in the waters again. And fingers crossed, if we get the funding, I'm doing another kind of big hypercomic exhibition in London in the summer. So it's kind of creeping back into my work a bit again at the moment, which has been fun because it's been nice to kind of go back there and see what new stuff there is to do and experiment a bit more. So I'm trying to kind of bring that back alongside my more traditional stuff.
Yeah, because that's what I was trying to get the rest of the guys into, because there's so many other, like we're interviewing all these pies, like Kieran Gillen and stuff, and he's also been doing webcomics, and we're trying to breach the gap, just not single issues and prints. We're trying to get sort of outside of the mainstream and do other stuff. But speaking of mainstream, that you also did the Iron Man 2020.
So, yeah, for Marvel, yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to read some of that as well so I can actually talk about it, but it was like Marvel's online thing is so strange. And
it's a little odd, yeah, their Marvel Digital Comics. It will get better, I presume. I haven't read it on, because they've been trying to put stuff out on various devices, various mobile devices now as well, I think. And I haven't looked at any of Marvel stuff on those. But yeah, their actual digital comics unlimited. I mean, I'm really glad it's there. I just don't like the interface as much as I could. Although then again, I haven't tried the full paid up version. I've only tried the free giveaway one.
Yeah, me too. So it's like you only get like four things, and even then it was like hard to read and stuff. Like, have you ever thought about talking to them? Because it's like, hey, study in this.
I figure they've got people that would do that. I mean, I'd love a go at it, and when I was working at Marvel, my editor at Marvel, John Barber, came from experimental webcomics anyway, and he really knew his stuff. So I figured if they wanted someone to do something like that, they had someone in house to do it anyway. So I just assumed that was happening somewhere else at Marvel. I'd be interested in it. I mean, when Sony were developing comics readers for the PSP, and I knew they were talking to Marvel about that anyway. So I kind of scratched that itch to an extent when I was doing that. But should the opportunity arise, I'd definitely be interested in doing something. But it's not something that seems... I don't really know how I'd go about pursuing it. It's kind of like, yeah, let me do a crazy internet comic featuring your characters and pay me to do it, please.
But I'll show you how!
it might work, but I'm not sure that it would.
No, I mean, I understand that. But it's just... You're doing so well with, like, the Rule of Death. The Rule of Death was the last thing that I read before I actually tried to call you. And it's probably, like, one of the most interesting things. I love how Douglas Noble sets the West so well.
Rule of Death is really mine and Douglas's comic. Douglas does a large amount of the heavy lifting on that comic. The process on Rule of Death isn't like anything else I really work on, because Douglas is has a very definite opinion as to what how to do a comic. So I write a script, and then I await with curiosity to see how the script is going to be interpreted into comics by Douglas, because while he always keeps what I want to happen and keeps most of my dialogue, the order in which the panels appear on the page are pretty much up for him to determine. I give him a guideline, like, this is roughly what's going to happen, and I write full script, but I know what I've written is going to be rearranged around how Douglas draws it. So it's much more of a collaboration than anything else I've done, because usually when I write script, I kind of expect the artist to just do what I tell them, more or less, but Douglas doesn't really like doing that. It's come out really well, so I don't really have any complaints, and he never makes any changes that aren't for the betterment of the work. But yeah, it's been going a long time as well. I kind of started it on a lark. It was going to be a kind of standalone series of jokes, and then about a week before we were due to start, I sent him an email saying, this isn't working, do you fancy doing a Western? And he was like, sure. And I just started sending him script, and I've been writing, kind of making it up as I go along ever since. But we really are getting to the point where... It probably needs to reach its ending soon. It's going to get interesting because we've got a lot of plates in the air at this point.
I noticed there's a lot of spinning plates, and I was just like, wonder, do you know when? Like, is there a certain level of finality is it going to come to?
I know the ending more or less, and I know I know the ending, and I know the epilogue, and I know kind of where we have to go to get there. But what tends to happen is that every scene or element I write, it gets more and more decompressed, and I guess we're kind of improvising around a basic structure. Each individual moment just takes longer and longer, so the ending never seems to get that much closer. But we really are getting to the point where it's almost to the final showdown. There's this mysterious character who I don't think has been named in the strip, but is called Klaus when me and Douglas talk about him, who's been getting closer and closer to the main character Pete Colby for the entire series, and finally actually appears on panel with one of the other main cast members at the end of this current chapter. So once that's happened, I have a feeling that the story has to kind of be finally barreling towards its conclusion, but I'm still not sure exactly how long that will take. At one point, I thought it might actually end this year, but then I realized that's only like 52 pages away, so it might not. We'll see how we do.
Speaking of the big book, I finally just thinking Necessary Monsters.
Yeah.
What do you want to tell? Because there's so many, you can read it yourself, you can do that, but like in your words, like what do you think about Necessary Monsters? And
it's quite good.
That was a bad phrasing of the question, obviously. But I think it was just like, well, like, what do you want to tell readers about
the pitch? Yeah, the pitch. Necessary Monsters is essentially the way I was pitching it in San Diego a couple of years ago. It's Freddy versus Jason meets Mission Impossible, only good. It's basically kind of a mashup of kind of spy thriller, Mission Impossible, Alias style book, and the kind of horror films I watched growing up, which was The Nightmare on Elm Streets and The Candymans and The Hellraisers and Friday the 13th movies. The kind of, I would say is modern horror, but this is modern horror like 10 years ago now, I guess. Those kind of bad guys, those kind of monsters. Because I was kind of felt that the kind of monsters you usually see in monster team-up books are always vampires, werewolves, and Frankenstein's monster, and we've kind of seen that quite a lot. But there haven't really been team-ups about these modern characters, and these modern characters are more, to me, are the kind of, they're just more fun and more horrible and more evil in some ways. And so I thought they'd be quite a lot of fun putting them together on a team and seeing what happens. So that was basically the pitch for the series. And it's it's a spy caper. The first arc is in five parts, which has all been serialized on the web across the last year at necessarymonsters.com. It's illustrated by Sean Azzopardi, who's a great artistic talent from the kind of British small press world. The book really came about because Sean said he wanted to draw a graphic novel for me, and I said okay, and then wrote Necessary Monsters. There you go. That's the book in a nutshell.
Because it's like I was gonna say something, but it's like I wouldn't give it justice. It'd be like, hey, it's Freddy Krueger and then it's Jason and it's all those people, but I feel like that sums it up perfectly, and I feel like it's such a great comic, and it's like as soon as I get like $20 like that I don't have to spend on like student loans or anything, then I was like I'll pick it up, because I want it like tangible in my hands, and I'll be putting links to all these those of you listening for like pretty much. Since all your stuff is online, I'll definitely.
I mean, the hope is that because we serialized it for free, the hope is that people enjoy it and then do want to buy the trade at the end. And it just seems to make sense to us to put it on the web and serialize it first on the web, because we've also been serializing it via like mini comics. So when we do conventions, we have little self-published minis of each of the chapters as standalone issues, but the. And just kind of get it out there to people as many different ways as possible. But the trade is still the kind of final aim, and it always has been to have this kind of book at the end, which is contains the whole thing. And it was very much kind of written for that final collected state. So I'm excited to see it's almost finally actually going to be out in shops.
And then judging by the sales, are you gonna continue with these characters in the story?
We both needed a break. Sean needed a break because he'd been like killing himself getting this thing drawn. A year and a half, and we were playing it very cool and saying like, well, if it sells well, maybe we'll do another volume. But we've kind of broken down in the last week or so and just said we're going to do some more, whatever happens. So yes, there will be a Necessary Monsters 2 that I'm starting to write at the moment I'm starting to make lots of notes on at the moment, because there's a lot like you can kind of do with the characters in the world, and I have to figure out what to actually do next with them, because I've probably got enough notes for an ongoing series if I thought that wouldn't kill Sean. So I have to figure out a way of what to actually do and what not to do at this stage.
I understand, because it's like you got so many titles already, it's like you don't want to keep going crazy. But
I mean, I could, because it's writing is never that much, you know, is never the bit that takes real time in comics, not really. But you can't, I mean, Sean's a writer artist in his own right, and I don't want this guy chained down to always drawing a spy horror comic for the rest of his natural life. So, I figure we've got at least another volume in us, so I'm going to try and make that as exciting as possible and have as much fun with it as possible.
So when going back to your new media, was your education in that the main precursor to start doing Necessary Monsters as a webcomic to use your ability to put that out there as, like, pseudo-free and then entice more?
I mean, I'd already been doing Rule of Death a while, so I'd done a few other serialized comics, but Necessary Monsters was my stab at the serialize on web and then collect in print model, which I could see becoming probably the dominant model for independent comic creators, and I wanted to try doing something that was very much that. And so Necessary Monsters was always like, it's going to be a trade. We got the publishing, we got AAD to agree to publish it before we started serializing it, so they were always on board. And then we started serializing on the web. So really, it's written for print, Necessary Monsters, not for the web. And then we used the web as a serializing tool. The biggest influence in doing that was probably, biggest single influence was probably Warren Ellis's Freak Angels, because I really saw that, I could really see that was someone who was clearly a print creator and was clearly writing a longer story for print, but was finding a way to make it work on the web as well. So that was probably like what I was closest to him. But having said that, I mean, things like Dirk Tiede's Paradigm Shift, which has been doing, been serialized online for a long time, and he's been self-publishing, is another great example of a kind of, like, cross-genre piece. So it's horror, but it's also kind of police procedural, being serialized on the web, being very, very successful on the web, and then also being collected in trades as well. So it's a model that works, I think.
And you see that as the new future model? I mean, not just for yourself, but just in general?
Well, I think so. I'd been saying that it would be for a while now, and I think it will be and is probably for a lot of new creators. But I having said that for a long time, I'm not actually sure what the various new devices like the Kindle are going to do to a model like that, because maybe there's actually staying digital as a sustainable model is actually possible now as well. I'm not sure. I mean, there are plenty of creators that make their living just from being on the web and don't have to worry about print collections at all. But I think that's harder for people telling longer stories rather than strips, you know, things working in the kind of newspaper strip format. So I always thought the trade was still a useful thing for people working in self-contained, you know, dramatic stories. But maybe the Kindle and the new iSlate, whatever it is, and Longbox changes this. I don't know. It's waiting to see if these things actually provide a really clear way of selling and monetizing electronic editions of comics. Then you maybe don't need the paper trade. But until they do that, I think that the trade is a real useful thing. And I think most creators will still have. There's no reason not to find a publisher or self-publish a trade paperback, because if you attend conventions, you will make money on it, because okay. You will sell these books at a convention, and you can probably also sell them through comic shops and other places. So the trade will be very useful for a while yet, I think.
Because that's what I was going for, this sort of line of questioning, just saying, like, is not really so much as like as trade as paper trail's gone or something, but I was trying to see, is this the future, and see, like. See if we can get like one of your, like a free lecture from Mr. Goodberg. But...
I mean, in terms of my expertise, I'm more about weird conceptual stuff than the kind of business model stuff, which I'm not great at. But I don't see a better model for independent comic creators. You can't. There's no real money in single issues, and you only reach the direct market by producing comics in single issues. Whereas for the web, it's very cheap overheads. You reach a much wider audience potentially of people who don't go into comic shops. And then once you've got the trade paperback at the end, once you hit that point, if you've got a readership, a big enough readership on the web, you can sell it to them and they will likely buy it. And you can also aim it then at comic shops or at bookshops or wherever. So it seems to me to make sense as a model. And the trade is still important because it's still something that people understand, especially if you want to look to get whatever you've done exploited in other media, because I think it's still much easier to, if you're trying to get, trying to sell the rights on a piece, to say, look, here's my book published by this publisher, than it is to say, look, here's my webcomic. That will change, and it probably is changing, but it's a useful thing. People understand a book in the way that they still don't quite understand a series on the web that's given away for free.
Yeah, I mean, that's understandable. I mean, like, I think the only argument for that would just be like, oh, there's more computers in households now than TVs, but I guess that's the...
I agree in terms of consumption. In terms of selling the rights on something, it's about what people who buy the rights on things consume things by, and I think they're still of the generation that's more comfortable having something to hold. But I don't think that, like I said, that will change. Whatever happens, I like print, and I think print will stay around for a long time after there's people consuming things digitally. So I always want to have, if I can, books in print as well as things on the screen.
Yeah, I think that niche will always exist. I mean, the niche, pretty much, because comic books are pretty much so like isolated as a market. But I think there's always going to be a store or something in some form. I think so.
I mean, I don't know what's going to happen to the direct market. That's another question. And I hope the direct market finds some way to survive. But there will hopefully always be good comic stores. And I want as many good comic stores as possible to survive. But I mean, print will always be around. But what it will likely become is a more fetishized object like vinyl does, as opposed to MP3s. So there will always be a market for it, and probably quite a substantial market for it. But it will be increasingly something where what you want is this nice artifact in front of you that really sets itself apart from the kind of experience you get from looking at the screen or the screen-like device if you've got a Kindle or whatever.
And I think that's perfect, you know, just saying like, yeah, it's like, who cares if you're reading Watchmen on your 60-inch plasma? I got it right here. It's warmer. And then you have that argument to the naysayers.
Yeah, absolutely. Although it would be nice to have... it's been a while since I bought a new copy of Watchmen, but it would be nice to have a copy of Watchmen where the pages don't fall out, which is my experience. Every copy of Watchmen I've owned, the pages have fallen apart. It has fallen apart. I don't know if they've started sewing it together better since the film came out, but... Yeah, it's not a book that stands the test of time in terms of physical editions.
And I think with that, in the future, I think that about does it for our lovely podcast. Let me get through the preliminaries for the goodbyes. But I think I got to say thank you, Daniel, for all this lovely news. I mean, not just for the stories that I've read early today. Like at 3 a.m. trying to do some actual research, but just for your insight in the future.
Dad, thanks, my pleasure. I feel like I should have talked about Necessary Monsters more. That's the book I need people to buy now. Buy Necessary Monsters. It's good.
Would you like to?
Okay. No, it's fine. They can read it on the web and decide for themselves. You see.
And I think it's
beautiful system.
Perfectly set. If you'd like to check out more exclusive interviews, podcasts, special editions, and more geeky goodness, be sure to check out our main site at breakthefourthwall.com. To get more of these lovely podcasts, subscribe to us via iTunes and be our friends and fans in MySpace and Facebook, respectively. And if you have any questions, comments, or complaints, please send us an email at contactfourthwall@yahoo.com. Once again, I must thank Mr. Goodbray for the lovely words and just being our guest today. And
my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And I'd like to thank you, our lovely audience, for listening. I'm Arthur Robinson, and you've just heard another Fourth Wall podcast.